Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons.
Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Hello.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
Hey, guys. We are recording this on a Sunday, and right about now, our governor is letting us know if we're getting locked down and for how long again. So we don't know what the actual thing is going on, but I have it on good authority that it's at least 4 weeks, and they're not calling it a lockdown this time. They're calling it a freeze.
That's very helpful.
I'm branding. Assuming because people would fucking riot if they thought they were being locked down again.
Probably. Oh, man. I guess we'll just find out, like, in our break whether or not.
Well, I know that restaurants will not be allowing people to dine in again, so yes, that'll be takeout only. A lot of the stuff that they had opened up for a little bit, they're shutting down.
I heard something about, like, reducing the stores down to 25% occupancy.
Yeah, I don't
know. That's going to be a hellscape. I don't know how they're going to do that right around the holiday season.
Well, they're definitely trying to get you to not do anything for the holidays, too. They're discouraging family gatherings and all that stuff.
Here comes Amazon with another $13 billion in a day.
Yeah, no kidding.
In my experience, get your DVDs now. People are going to do what they're going to do. So you telling people that they can't get together on Thanksgiving is going to result in 0% compliance.
Yeah, it's true. It's funny. My family kept trying to, like, skirt the system because we're all in Washington State. And so it started with, like, oh, maybe, like, people can just make sure during Thanksgiving somebody stops by and says hi to grandma. Then it became like, let's have a outdoor potluck where we just leave prepackaged items of food for everybody outside of grandma's. Then it was like, well, while you're there, maybe you just hang out outside and talk to grandma and each other if you happen to also be there. And I was just like, oh my God, you guys, you need to stop. Like,
I see what you're doing.
Yeah, totally. I was like, I already know I have to cook all of our meal anyway because I'm the able-bodied one of the family. So I was like, I'm not doing this twice. Like,
right.
Good luck. I'll say hi to grandma, but I'm not hanging out with y'all or cooking for you. So
I like that they thought that Thanksgiving Day is somehow going to be nice enough that you can stand around outside and have a discussion. We all know it's going to be pouring down rain.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I don't know. I mean, I don't care as much about Thanksgiving. It's never been a big deal for my family to that extent. But, like, Christmas is going to suck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanksgiving ended for me long ago when I moved here and my family still live in Idaho.
I
did the sitcom life where I was the one of three people left in the dorm during Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Sure. And I always pretended that I didn't have any family because hanging out with my family that much is just not a good thing. In fact, everyone who would complain online about, hey, you know, Black Friday, how about you spend some more time with your family? Why do you have to go shopping the day after Thanksgiving? Why is that so important? I'm like, don't fucking tell me what to do. I am not hanging out another day with these fucking weirdos.
Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, I lived in the UK for so long that holidays sort of lost all meaning. Like, I would go back for Christmas, but, like, everything, like 4th of July, Thanksgiving, like, all of that was just, I wasn't going to spend like $1,000 to fly home for that. So I was the one on the phone that got passed around the family occasion. Hello. Yes.
Nice.
Well, in lieu of all of our theaters closing and all of that stuff, I saw a movie that is possibly available to rent in theaters right now, though.
Did you see it in theaters?
That's none of your business, is it?
Move along. Nothing to see here.
I mean, you're allowed to, so it's okay. I mean, plenty of people are going to movie theaters. And
boy, okay. She just didn't get that.
I did not see it in theaters. No.
Oh, okay. No, I'm sorry. I thought you were just being, like, coy about having gone
to a
movie theater.
I'm being coy about how I watch this film, okay?
Jeez. Well, you know what? I don't care. You could have just lied to the audience and made everyone feel like you were still ethically, you know, on the right compass.
All right. Well, with that in mind, I went to the theater. It was just me.
Sure.
And I got myself a large popcorn.
Nice.
That is delicious.
And I watched The New Mutants.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
It is not the worst movie I've ever seen, and not even this year.
Wow.
Which
high makes it more frustrating.
Oh, really?
Because it is not a good movie.
Okay. So it was like almost could have been good.
Man, there is stuff in there that I was like, oh, there's a glimmer of somebody who has actually read the comics writing this story.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It really felt to me like this was originally written as a Nightmare on Elm Street sequel.
Oh, what?
And then they said, well, let's take that idea and put mutants into it.
Whoa. What?
So the story is based, of course, on the storyline, the Demon Bear saga that Chris Claremont wrote and Bill Sienkiewicz drew back in 84-ish,
something like that,
pretty early on. And that story kind of defined the New Mutants going forward.
Oh, yeah. But it also altered comic book art.
Yeah.
Which I think is, I don't know. Jump in real quick because I haven't seen it yet, but it seems like a poor choice for New Mutants story, because I think that was an important story for the New Mutants. But if John Byrne had drawn it, it would have just been, this is a good
right.
New Mutants story. But since the art was so revolutionary and so different, it elevated the entire story to be bigger than it was. And that that would be a story you should do on movie 3.
Yeah, the thing is that art could have translated very well to this movie because it's a horror film. It is definitely a horror film. It is a PG-13 horror film, which is not great. The casting is almost perfect for a lot of it.
Wow.
The only person I didn't like was Sam, played by one of the leads in Stranger Things.
Oh.
The boy of the brother who disappeared.
Oh, sure. He's a little bit of a rag.
He's also British, playing a Southern American boy.
Oh, no.
With a bit of an accent that doesn't quite work. And he just didn't have the right look for me, you know, and that's because those characters, especially when this story came out, it was maybe 2 years into the New Mutants, we'd gotten to know who they all were, and that was what allowed this crazy story to be told. That's tough when this movie is also a origin story of all of them meeting each other. You don't know anything about any of them, and the stuff that you do know is from the comics. So when it strays from that, you're like, "What are you doing?" But the gal who played Magic, Ileana, is Anna Taylor from. Oh, boy. What is she from? You'd know her. She's got gigantic eyes. She looks very Slavic, you know. She's I think she was in... Why can't I think of it?
I have, like, an image in my head of who this person is, and it's just so random that I would laugh if I got it right.
Anna Taylor-Joy? Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Yeah. Anna Taylor-Joy.
Was she in The Witch?
Yes.
Okay, this is the girl from The Witch.
The daughter.
Yes. And she's... pitch perfect. Man, she looks just like her. And even when she transforms into Magic, she's got the one armored arm and the energy sword.
Oh, jeez.
And Eric, when you do see it, you're going to like the fact that Lockheed shows up and not in the way that you think. But you're like, oh, this is nice. Somebody understood the comic enough that we were like, we need to see Lockheed. And there's just enough... those little points happening throughout the story that you're like, oh, god dang it, this is just fan service. But for some reason, Josh Boone didn't realize that the whole movie had to be fan service. That's what comic book movies are.
Yeah.
So I'm not against the idea of throwing superheroes into a horror film.
No.
But, you know, then you gotta land the superhero parts.
Yeah.
So.
Interesting. I mean, like, I was originally pretty excited about it, and then it kind of went into post-development hell.
Yeah.
Where I've been seeing trailers for this thing for, what, 3-4 years now?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
So I've been excited, and then heard that it was shit, and then my favorite film reviewer, Mark Kermode, was like, actually, it's fine. It's just fine. So that's kind of where my expectations have been at.
Kind of what you're saying. It's
right.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's fine.
Looking up on IMDb, holy crap, that guy's wrong for Sam.
Yeah.
I mean, that is wide-eyed innocent guy, and that guy looks like probably better off on the villain side or yeah. the darker character side.
Yeah, Sam in the comics, of course, is tall, lanky, and incredibly naive, yeah. and you know he kind of plays him that way, but it doesn't work with the way he looks.
Really. Yeah, he's a really
he's a hardened looking kid.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This kid's lived some life.
The other problem is that the effects in this are fine, and the demon bear is a gigantic demon bear, but he looks like a gigantic bear. And
right.
when you see the comic book, Sienkiewicz's bear is so fucking evil looking and scary looking on the page that, you know, you're like, wow, we are dealing with something crazy here. Yeah. And I don't know why they didn't use that kind of design for this bear. Made more frustrating by the fact that the end credits roll over Sienkiewicz images of the characters and the bear and stuff like that. Geez. And I thought, is this the pre-production sketches or something? And I looked into it. No, he was hired to just draw images for the end credits. Why wouldn't you take the guy and say, how about you design our demon bear?
Yeah, at least do that. Nothing, you know, you don't have to be your full art designer, but do, jeez.
Yeah. So you can understand my frustration. Yes. It's like, boy, this is almost there.
Damn. Would you say that you liked it more than the other recent X-Men movies that have come out?
Well, I mean, so like
other than Logan.
Age of Apocalypse yes. or something like that, or the Dark Phoenix one, yeah, this is head and shoulders above both of those films.
Okay. Well, that's something at least, because I sat through all of those, mostly on airplanes, when I was like, I never got around to seeing Dark Phoenix. Let's see if they best the Fox Kids version.
They did not.
But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely interested in checking it out. And, you know, I know you got to see it in theaters, but I'm just going to have to find a way to see if I can, you know, maybe it's out on VOD. I'll have to find out.
Oh, maybe it's on demand.
If I can find a way to demand it.
You'll get on it?
I'll get on it.
And
you remember
our frustration also that they decided it had to open in theaters and it didn't open in VOD on the same day. And we were like, "What? Why wouldn't you do this? Why would you risk this kind of backlash?"
Right.
And Josh Boone actually talked about that and said, here's the problem. When you do these movies, you make and sign contracts without knowing that a pandemic is going to come along. And the contract says this film sits in a theater for this amount of time before it can go online, even if there's no movies in theaters.
That's right. It was pretty much the only movie in any open theaters for a long time. So I would be surprised if it did poorly. Right. It should have at least made its money.
I don't think it made its money.
Really? No, there's no way.
Well, not in this climate. It might have been able to make its money if people could go to a movie theater. But
yeah, I guess it's so hard because all my friends in back in the UK are all seeing movies because, you know, they fucked up and everyone's allowed to do whatever they want. And so I'm just like, so they've all seen Tenet like 10 times.
Oh,
jeez.
Another film I have not yet seen.
Well, Europe is shutting down hard right now.
I know.
I know.
It's beautiful.
Thanks to your friends going to the movies.
I'm sure that's 100% what it is.
What have you seen?
So I'm now caught up as of last night on The Mandalorian.
Me as well.
Are you caught up on the scandal?
No.
Stupid scandal.
What scandal?
They want to cancel Baby Yoda.
Why?
Because he ate those eggs. What a dick thing for a baby to do.
What? Yeah. Wait, for real?
You haven't seen this actual outrage?
No.
You know, Eric and I have a thing that we have talked about, but this was probably BV, and that is nobody hates Star Wars more than Star Wars fans.
Yeah.
And so they will fucking complain about anything.
Yes.
Yes, they are the opposite of Star Trek fans in every way. We are a good people. I will say, if you're on the Star Trek forums, they're very loving. But yeah, that sucks. So it's just Star Wars people being like, I mean, it's not like there's any kind of specific canon they can possibly be mad about.
I wonder if it's really Star Wars fans or just
people who need
look,
to be right.
I don't want to assign a gender to these people, but middle-aged women who love this show for one reason, and that is Baby Yoda. And then when Baby Yoda doesn't act the way they think he should, they're like, what is going on?
Oh my God.
But shouldn't those be the ones who realize that a baby will put anything in its mouth?
That's what I'm thinking. Like, I found it. It brought such a level of fun tension that I was like screaming at my TV, don't leave him alone.
Yes.
Like, don't let him have it. But like at the same time, you know, it's that's the joy of something like that. It's dirty, dusky Star Wars.
And then he ate a spider. Too,
he did eat a spider and he ate like a squiddy thing. And he eats anything.
Clearly eats everything that is put in front of him.
Exactly. Yeah, he gets very excited about it. That he has some kind of weird... He's not a normal human being baby, shockingly.
I love it because it brings me back to Yoda making a meal for Luke in his little hut and Luke saying, I'm not eating this.
Yes. Exactly. Like it feels more true to, I feel like this whole show feels more true to Star Wars than anything else I've seen probably in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised watching it last night because I just recently watched a Clint Eastwood movie. Holy shit, that guy sounds like a young Clint Eastwood. Mm. His line delivery and stuff.
Pedro?
Yeah. It was flooring
me. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. He has a great voice. It's kind of, actually, it's kind of nice not seeing his face to a certain extent because he does
he's such a distortedly ugly man.
No, he's just got a kind of squishy face. I don't think you look at him and like terror rings. You know, he doesn't have a lot of strong angles or like... really like harsh shapes to it, which you almost want from a character like that, like somebody like Clint Eastwood, but his voice is phenomenal. So
hey, let's give a little spoiler warning here for the next 30 seconds or something, because I want to talk about The Mandalorian. I was fascinated to see that in this latest episode, I can't remember her name now, but they pull off their Mandalorian helmets, and he's so upset about it. And you realize that he is part of a cult.
Yeah. That
and
was
he didn't know
amazing.
He was part of a cult. And I was like, well, this is a neat level. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it did make me wonder, because if you watch the Clone Wars series or Rebels, they've got Mandalorians in there who are constantly taking off their helmets. So I was wondering in this series, I was like, when did they say that they couldn't do this? So that was a really neat revelation.
Yeah, that was really good in there.
And the like different, and it's neat too because the their armor is painted so differently.
Looked cool.
Yeah,
I liked the blue armor.
Awesome, and it was sort of like, oh hey, like that makes sense. They're you know it's a culture of people, and they all kind of went in their own directions, but they all have the same sort of skill set and mindset. It's just a little bit. Some of them don't take off their helmets.
Yeah. So they keep having these great guest stars too, and then they're like Timothy Oliphant or. What's his name? The director in the first season.
Oh,
the guy who hired him. You know what I'm talking about.
Verna?
Yeah. They're in like barely in it, then they're gone. It's like, oh, man.
It was fun.
More only fun. And apparently the bartender in that scene was the bartender from Deadwood. We couldn't see him because he's covered in
stuff.
Makeup, but yeah.
Oh, that's so fun. I think Jon Favreau just like nailed it. He just nailed this whole thing. I don't know what it was that caused Disney to go ahead and take a risk. Maybe they just didn't think it was a risk because I don't know if it's somehow lower budget or what.
I mean, if he came to them with a script and those designs, the art that they show in the closing credits every time, Disney's probably like, here's a check. Have fun.
Go wild. Man, I am excited just to have like an art book from this show come out because those sketches are gorgeous. They're gorgeous. And it shows you kind of what their intention is originally.
And they get pretty close.
They
do. I'm sure they pick ones that closest resemble the final product as well, but pretty close.
God, it's so good. Oh, yeah. That's one of those shows that it's so delightful and it just brings so much joy. Like each episode has... It's just fun.
Yep.
I don't know where the heck they're going with it, but I don't even care. I'm like, I'm enjoying this journey plenty.
And we've talked about this in the first season. They do the right thing. They don't shoehorn a length of an episode. I mean, yesterday's episode or last episode was like half an hour.
Yeah.
Oh, was
like,
it?
They do the length. Not,
I mean, notice. I think the first episode this season was like 47 minutes. And then just, whatever the story takes. Yeah. I like that.
That is super smart. It's super, super smart. Because it's always the right act structure. So that's probably why I haven't noticed. Is I'm like, the story had like the beginning, middle, and end. And it worked beautifully.
Yep.
So well, what about you, Eric? What have you been checking out?
A very different film.
Ooh.
the Black Christmas remake that was controversial a few years ago.
Which remake? The most recent remake.
Yeah, right? The one that got all the little boys and their computers all angry and butthurt about it.
Okay.
It was fine. I mean, I thought the best part of the movie was one of the things that probably pissed off that crowd the most. The song they did, where they performed like in the little Santa Claus costumes and she accused the guy.
Yes. Right in front.
I thought that was a great scene.
Yeah.
But it's just fine.
That's 100% how I felt about that movie too. It was absolutely fine.
With all the outrage, I wasn't even going to watch it because it's just not my kind of movie. And the first one I liked well enough, but I was like, I'm not sure this needed to be remade.
Twice.
And then all the outrage, I was like, well, I got to see this now. And then I was like pissed off that the outrage was over nothing also.
Yeah, yes. I would say like the only thing that I could find that maybe would be upsetting is it is pretty far away from the source material.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, I don't know why they called it Black Christmas, frankly. Like, they could have really...
Well, marketing.
Yeah.
It's sort of like The Lawnmower Man. They had the one scene where she put the bag over the guy's head. It's like, okay, well, that's like the original. And the one scene in Lawnmower Man was like the book. But the rest was just nothing.
Yeah. Nothing at all. I mean, I always enjoy seeing Cary Elwes, so that's always fun.
Yeah.
Even if, like, there was a lot of storylines that were really nothing storylines, but there were some fun moments.
Yep.
The overall cult stuff was good.
Did you watch that on Shudder?
HBO Max, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I only ask because I watched finally the Creepshow animated special from Halloween.
Oh, how was that?
Animated is technically correct.
Oh, no. Is it like one of those cheap effects they throw on?
It's so more it's like an animatic.
Right.
Yeah,
it's like a moving comic book, those kind of animated things that you see.
Yeah, that one a few years ago with Keanu Reeves kind of thing, where it's this weird heavy philosophy film.
Oh
no, it's not like that. Okay. It's like GIF animation. Oh. So it's an image, and the image can be complicated or not, but only one thing moves in it, and perhaps it's the hand or something like that.
Yeah, like it's a still image and you almost maybe it'll like tilt and zoom in a little.
Right.
Okay.
So that's what this is about. And in fact, you know, there's dialogue in it. The mouths don't move to the dialogue or anything like that. So it's a pretty cheap animation. That being said, it's two short stories, one of them based on one of my favorite Stephen King stories, so that was kind of neat to see, and the other one based on one of my least favorite Joe Hill stories. So on top of the bad animation, I got a story that I didn't love. I have said this from the beginning. I am really happy that there is a Creepshow series. That makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't liked much of it at all.
Right.
Oh, dear.
So,
I mean, but at least sparking that fire is nice because it's like, oh, maybe something will come of this if people...
Season two or three will improve.
The problem is, when you were talking about how Demon Knight is not an official Tales from the Crypt story because it's not a morality play, which is what those stories were. Well, the original Creepshow came out in 1982, well before Tales from the Crypt.
Oh, yeah.
But it was an homage to the Tales from the Crypt comics, and they told those kind of stories in Creepshow. Now Creepshow has come out after, whatever, 9 or 10 seasons, excellent seasons of Tales from the Crypt, and they've got to kind of distance themselves from that.
Yeah.
But that means they are no longer what Creepshow was either. And so they're just horror stories, and doesn't quite work.
Yeah, that's a little bit different. I think similarly, what I also checked out this week was Mortuary Collection.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Also, I believe on Shudder.
I talked about this earlier, and I remember you saying I was going to avoid this because it's an anthology film.
Yes. I've definitely had a hard time with anthology films, and I don't know if I'm starting to wonder if I just don't like them, which feels really unfair because maybe, I don't know, I don't hate short films.
I was going to say, it's just three short films.
Yeah. Mortuary Collection was actually pretty neat. Yeah. I liked the wraparound. I felt like it was much stronger than they normally are.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was as opposed to a beginning and an end that sort of just pops up with a line or two in the middle. It was an actual story.
Yeah.
Right. It's really good. Exactly. As opposed to like the the polar opposite with body bags of John Carpenter being like, look, I'm John Carpenter and I'm unzipping a bag. Ooh, like, good job. Yeah, this definitely had like, and it was a, I found that story, the one that tied back into the wraparound, genuinely pretty upsetting, which was great. I don't know, like overall, each of the stories felt pretty good. The first one is very, very short, but like to the point and, you know, solid. The next one, I believe, is the teen sex one. And that was super fun and ridiculous. And yeah, was there only three in that?
Yeah, there's three in the wraparound. I don't remember the third. The third tied into the...
I think the third was the wraparound.
That was the babysitter.
Yeah, the babysitter one, yeah.
Which I thought was fun.
It was fun. Yeah, I mean, it was almost near the end, pretty predictable, but like, I mean, I don't even like straight up gore for the sake of gore, but it definitely worked in that. Like, I just, it felt pretty just, you know, silly and enjoyable.
Clancy Brown was awesome.
Yeah.
His voice.
Yes.
I'll just listen to him talk.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do like that they went there. There was a lot of moments where they could have been like, you know what? Too dark. But like that that kind of image of having children be put in danger, they just were like fine with it. And that was, I think that's what horror films should have.
Yeah.
It should be okay.
Yeah. Speaking of predictable and but fun, I watched another Kelly recommendation last night, Love and Monsters.
Oh my God. I am still really keen to see this. So what did you think?
Pure fun. It's just fun. Mm-hmm. You're right. It is. There's nothing that happens in that movie that you don't see coming for miles away. Like when he goes through the training with the one guy and the flower and all. I mean, it's, I'm not spoiling anything for anybody that knows movies, but who cares? The lead guy is so much fun.
Oh.
And oh shit. What's his name? Henry.
No, I can't think of his name either.
He's the brother on Walking Dead that cut off his hand.
Yondu in the Galaxy, Guardians of the Galaxy, and Henry in Henry Portrait of Him.
You all know who he is. Just none of us can think of his name at the moment. But his him and his daughter or the kid that he was with were a lot of fun. And and what happens at when he arrives is, I mean, everything is easily predictable, but the monsters are cool. They look pretty good. And it's just a fun watch. You know,
I would have been happy to see this in the theater.
Yeah.
I just, you know, like I said, I think that was the one that got me a little teary-eyed at the end, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I was like, oh, boy, this is how I'm a pussy I am.
Aw.
Yeah. Nope. I say if you don't, then there's something wrong with you, man. It's just...
still only a rental, right?
Yes.
What did you pay for it?
It's the $20 rental.
Yeah. Okay. I was hoping it had come down from that. It's a movie ticket priced movie, but I did not feel bad about that at all.
No, it was fine. If you want a nice little escapism movie that is not going to challenge and it's just going to give you a nice little cut from all this crap going on right now, this is a really good choice.
Yeah. It is. It's a feel good movie.
Yep.
All right, guys, should we take a little break and then come back and we are talking small town horror?
Sounds good.
Destination Small Town, a KLUK TV production. The challenge to share what's happening in small towns of the Midwest. The stories are real. The pace is swift, with tourists, celebrities, and reporters from Sweet Swine County covering stories about businesses and points of interest. Destination Small Town, in living color on the web.
We are back. Vanessa, this was your topic, so why don't you start us off?
Absolutely. Well, I'm really excited because this is a film that I've been intending to talk about for a little while now, and this was just the perfect excuse for it. I am going to be discussing the small town horror of Dead and Buried.
This is the road to Potter's Bluff. Maybe you've been there. Clean, picturesque, full of old-fashioned friendliness. The kind of town everyone likes to visit. This is the road to Potter's Bluff. There is no road out.
Welcome to Potter's Bluff.
From the creators of Alien, terror brought down to Earth, dead and buried.
Is there any way whatsoever to reanimate people after they have died? To get them to walk around?
That guy, the one you came to see me about last week, the one that died after the car wreck.
Yeah.
I just saw him.
Man, he's dead. The same guy.
Welcome to Potter's Bluff.
When you die, you expect to remain dead and buried.
You had a very close call. Just lie still. I'm gonna give you something. It's gonna make you feel even better.
When you die in Potter's Bluff, expect the unexpected. From the creators of Alien, dead and buried, it will take your breath away, all of it, dead and buried.
I love this movie.
Yes.
Yeah, I saw it for the very first time last year, so it was actually kind of a joy to rewatch it and to see if I actually liked it as much as I thought I liked it. That's always a fun endeavor, and it definitely held up. It's
nice.
God, it's a cool film. I'd never heard of it until like somebody literally put it on in front of me. So I'm hoping that if anyone out there hasn't seen it, this will get you excited about it. This is one of the weird ones where it has for Rotten Tomatoes, it has a 75% critics and a 58% audience, where it's kind of opposite of what I think. Like, why would critics like this more than audience members?
I think so. Did you say what year this was?
1981.
81. Mm-hmm. I think that as far as horror movies went, we were into a certain pattern. You know, we were getting our Friday the 13th, our Halloween, stuff like that. And here comes this kind of smart thriller, and I think that's why the critics liked it, and the audience was like, nah, there's way too much thinking in this.
No Jason, where's the machete?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I would definitely believe you on that.
This is rated R, isn't it? Do you know?
You know,
offhand?
I don't know offhand, but it has to be. There's no way it's not. Okay. I mean, it's
explicit. It's been a while since I've seen it.
It was part of the Video Nasties as well.
Oh,
so it?
Okay.
Must have been. The gore in this film, I will say, is phenomenal. Like, in the first 10 minutes, you see somebody burn alive.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
It's pretty incredible, but I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself on this. Director is Gary Sherman, who was the producer of Poltergeist 3 and the Poltergeist Legacy TV series, which I know nothing about. That was 1997. Dead and Buried is actually the third film he ever directed. He also did direct Poltergeist 3 and another film called Lisa, which had a lot of cool posters that I've never heard of, but it looked great. So maybe I'll hunt it down. There are 5 writers on this, and it's very confusing because the first 2 have literally written nothing other than this, which is Jeff Miller and Alex Stern. And then the screenplay, it says, is by Ronald Shusett, who's the writer of the Alien screenplay, and Dan O'Bannon, who we know very well, who started off with Carpenter on Dark Star and then also worked on Alien, Return of the Living Dead, Life Force, Screamers. But actually, Dan O'Bannon says he did not write anything having to do with this film.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, like Schuster passed it his way and was like, or Shusett passed it his way and said, hey, buddy, good old friend pal, why don't you put your pen to paper on this guy? And yeah, and Dan O'Bannon didn't he went over the script, he made some changes, and then when he saw it, he realized nothing he wrote got in.
Oh wow.
And they just wanted his name. That was all it came down to.
Sure.
So he's
Alien.
Yeah, exactly. He was like pissed about it. So it's really, I guess, Shusett is the writer of this.
How funny, because I've always thought this was a Dan O'Bannon scripted movie.
He totally just owns it, and he's like pissed about it too.
Wow. Well, not anymore, but.
Well, sure. He's moved on to other things. Starring James Ferrantino. Now, he looked so familiar to me, but there's nothing that he's been in that I've seen. So it's very weird. He was in Final Countdown and Dynasty. In this, he's playing the small town sheriff, Dan Gillis. But this guy has been around. He's been in 93 things. So you'll definitely recognize him, or think you recognize him like I did. He actually had a little bit of a rough career after he was charged with stalking his ex, Tina Sinatra, daughter of Frank Sinatra. He basically retired from acting. He had some health difficulties and passed away in 2012. But yeah, so this guy's weird. Every time I look at him, I'm like, you're from something. Apparently, you're from looking through this poor girl's window at some point.
Oh, man.
Melody Anderson plays his wife, Janet Gillis. She's just stunning. She's a beautiful human being. She's only been in 36 things, but they're pretty notable. She was in Flash Gordon. She was in Battlestar Galactica as Brenda Maxwell. And 78 episodes of All My Children. She also played Bonnie in the Elvis TV movie. So I was like, oh, now I have a reason to rewatch the Elvis TV movie, considering I did not enjoy it. And last but not least, the other big name on this, and probably arguably the biggest name, is Jack Albertson as William G. Dobbs. He's been in 181 things, and the name might not sound familiar, but he was Grandpa Joe in Willy Wonka. So... you know, he also played Amos in, he was the voice of Amos in Fox and the Hound the same year as Dead and Buried came out. And then played Manny in Poseidon Adventure. This was actually his final role. Oh, and I should also mention there's one other like recognizable face that I was like, is that? No. Is that? No. Robert Englund is in this.
Oh, wow.
As, he actually plays somebody named Freddy.
Holy shit.
But it's 3 years before Nightmare on Elm Street came out. Weirdly. Super weirdly. Oh, so I think, I mean, I didn't rewatch it to figure out exactly who he was, but I think he's like the second murder victim.
Oh, he's murdered? I was going to say, are you exposing a prequel to Nightmare on Elm Street?
You know what? Could be.
How was he murdered? Was he murdered by a gang of angry parents?
Burned?
He was murdered by a gang of... people. So
halfway there.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of brings us into the plot of this. All right, the scene. There's a beach. It's a beautiful day. A photographer is walking down a coastal line, looking at the birds and the ocean, taking photos. Suddenly a beautiful woman comes up to him and starts talking his ear off and says, oh, do you think I could be a model? And he's like, oh, honey, let me tell you, you are model quality. You get in front of this camera. And she does. And then she starts to take her clothes off. And he's like, okay.
Dear penthouse, I never believed your letters before,
but today. And so she comes up to him. She's like, do you want to make love on this fine, fine beach, sir? And he's like, yes, I do. And then, like, as soon as he says yes, like 20 people just come out of nowhere on this beach and just are like, hey, and start taking pictures of him and beating him with, like, clubs and stuff. Then they wrap him up in like a sea net, like a fishing net, around a pole and light him on fire.
This is not what I thought when you said, do you want to make love?
Yeah, he was very disappointed. Very, very disappointed. And that sets us up for the film. I do love this kind of opening scene because it has such like creepy, almost like Wicker Man vibes, I want to say. Like it just is really, and it's great too because they start off with the line of welcome to Potter's Bluff. Which reminds me of, you guys probably haven't seen The OC, but in the first episode, like, a new kid shows up, and they beat the crap out of him, and they go, welcome to The OC, bitch. I was like, yeah, welcome to Potter's Bluff, bitch.
Wow.
Oh, so good.
The OC, badass land.
Orange County, yo. The investigation starts for this guy's death. He's found in the next scene in an upside down burned out vehicle as if this was a natural occurrence. Yes. And the sheriff is on the scene. So we get introduced to Sheriff Dan Gillis. He's kind of poking around. He's like, where's that damn mortician? Is he showing up anytime soon? And sure enough, in a sort of Ghostbusters-esque hearse,
that's right,
with music blaring out like 1930s tunes, this guy is just so happy as can be. This mortician shows up, rolls in. He's like, what's the haps, yo? But in like a 80, 90 year old man voice, goes over, pokes at the what they believe to be a corpse, and the victim opens his eyes. So the potential for, oh my God, what happened here? Is he going to be able to reveal what has occurred? We then follow the sheriff around as basically anyone who enters this town is murdered like immediately. Yeah. Does not matter who they are. There's a hitchhiker. There's a guy who's just drunk who almost feels like he must be a local, but I don't think he is from the plot. And then a family with their young son, all of whom do not survive just stepping foot in this town. Also, the townspeople are very strange. It's really hard to pin down what's going on with them, like why they're murdering everybody. And as the film progresses, and the sheriff is just at total dead ends all throughout the film, up until he sees a car speed past him, which actually incidentally has the young couple and their child who are trying to run away from a mob of crazy people. He hits somebody and gets out of his car and is like, oh my God, like literally like slams into a human body. The person runs off and he's like, what, where are you going? Looks at his front grill and there is an arm moving its hand attached to his grill. Now he gets, this is where we get really spoilery. So anyone who is interested in seeing this, I really think you should see it. It has a really cool twist, but I do have to spoil it just to talk about this in any further way. They test the hand and it is 3 months old, dead, 3 months old.
Dead for 3 months?
Okay. Not a 3 month old dead arm. It's an arm that has been dead for at least 3 months. And we discover that this mortician has this really crazy obsession with fixing up dead people. And he's just so talented at it that it's like works of art for him, and he's found a way.
Dr. Frankenstein?
My God. He's found a way to reanimate. And I love it because when he goes into the evil dead speech, or not dead speech, I'm sorry, the evil villain speech at the end there, he just goes, now, you might wonder how I've managed to bring all these people back from the dead, but I'll go to my grave with that secret. And I was like, bravo, sir. Thank you. Don't explain it. I don't want to know. Nice. I just don't. But I will say, even knowing that basically all of these people in the town are walking dead pieces of art, I guess, it's actually still got just a ton of joy in seeing. Because I was wondering if it would hold up having known the twist. And there are further twists that I won't reveal. Really, you have to get to the end to just see how magnificent this movie is. But just watching these deaths, it's really incredible. There's one where they fill up a guy's face with acid and watch it explode. You're just like, this guy really tortures himself for his art. Like they have
and everybody else.
And yes. Everybody else. Yeah. The hitchhiker, like they literally take a giant rock and smash her head in. I'm like, you are getting yourself a chore, sir. You're starting from scratch. You're like, I want to see if I can get back to from point zero. Like, let's just not even have a head on this woman. See if I can like start over with her. Yeah, seriously though, the deaths are absolutely amazing. They completely go there. It's really a joy to check out. There's a lot of feeling to it that reminded me of the way I feel when I watch The Fog, where it's just eerie and otherworldly, but familiar at the same time. Yeah. And I think they really nailed that down. There's great characters throughout. I mean, even people who you only see for like a minute. So aside from like the mortician, who's just a joy to watch, there's like the sheriff's wife, who she's barely in it, but she's this like spunky, kooky, fun teacher who's like teaching her kids about witchcraft because she wants to keep them quote unquote interested. Definitely may or may not have anything to do with what's going on in the town. Like the assistant to the mortician is like super into weed. Like everybody sort of has a thing. Except for, I think, the sheriff. And that's probably the thing I dislike about this film. I feel like the sheriff is so dull.
Is he the main guy?
He's the main guy.
Yeah, he's trying to unravel the mystery.
He's trying to unravel the mystery. We're with him through the whole experience. And, you know, there are really fun... There are all these fun moments, but his reaction, he's so in the dark as to what's going on that we're so much further ahead from him as the audience, sure, that it's almost like, just figure it out. Like, we're like, oh my God, hey, that guy who died in the first scene is back and living and he's pumping gas. And it's like, which by the way, is also interesting. I don't know why they all get like really dumb dead end jobs when they come back from the dead, but that's pretty great. But yeah, but the guy, you know, he just doesn't
see
it.
So fucking critical. I mean, this guy was dead and now he's working and you're like, you couldn't get a better job.
I think he could. Hey man, he had an eye. He was a photographer. He was going places like with naked chicks on beaches. Right. But now he's just pumping gas and wearing the outfit. Like, he basically regressed like 15 years of his own career. So.
Wow.
I will say though, there is an amazing moment where, like, when he's taking photos on the beach, he's wearing this very, very early 80s sweatshirt that's just classic, like wrapped around shoulder kind of scenario, really bad. And when
pastel color
when they open up his casket, all that remains is a part of his body wrapped up in that sweater. Like, yes, bring the sweater back. Yeah, so that's kind of all I really have to say about this film. There's not very much info on it that I could find as far as like behind the scenes fun info. And I think there's got to be a really cool story behind it, but it was not anywhere obvious online. Like the box office, I know, was $216,000.
Oh,
ouch.
Yeah. Right. What was the budget? Who knows?
Well, more than that.
Yeah. Must have been. But probably, you know, it looks like a pretty cheap, I mean, aside from the effects, which by the way, the effects were done by Stan Winston.
Oh, jam.
So that was pretty cool. Originally this was intended to be a dark comedy, but I guess Gary Sherman like chickened out and changed lanes. So that's okay. I think it's still super, super fun. The director, here are the few facts I have. The director avoided using any red in any scene because he wanted to reserve it only for blood. So he replaced the taillights of all the cars with purple lights.
Oh, all right.
Okay, yeah. Sure.
I don't think it's noticeable at all.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, that would draw me out of a movie. I'd be like, why are these lights purple?
It's just pointless. Like, all of it's really, I don't know why he did it, because I don't remember the blood being particularly... I don't even
wasn't
remember.
Wasn't giallo blood or anything like
no,
that?
No, it wasn't. I don't even remember blood now that I think about it. Like, I'm sure there is some, but the one other fun thing that I found on this was that the hand that is on the grill that's like moving around, that it's sort of an arm and a hand, was actually, it was before animatronics were a thing. So the way that Stan Winston pulled this off was they had a woman hiding underneath the car, puppeteering the arm with their hand sticking out the grill, nice, which I thought was very clever. Also, there was a novelization of this written after the movie by Miss Chelsea Quinn Yarborough.
I read that.
Did you really?
Yeah, I read that before I saw the movie.
Was it good?
Yeah. That was why I went and saw the movie.
Oh, okay.
A little glimpse into how my mind works. I liked the book. I saw the movie. I didn't like the movie. I didn't like the movie until I saw it again in the theater at the Lovecraft Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
In 2003 or something.
Right.
And I watched it as an adult, and I was like, why don't I think I, or why do I think I don't like this movie? Yeah. This movie is amazing.
Yeah. So. It's weird. I think like it can be, it can feel a little slow and it's very dark. I'd say a lot of the set feels, I don't know, some of the locations feel pretty cheap, but the effects so much make up for it as far as like all the murders. They're just so
fun. Has it gone through a remastering or anything like Shout Factory or somebody
gotten
a hold of it?
I haven't come across anything like that. I found it for free to watch on
Tubi?
Shudder?
YouTube? Oh,
okay. Oh, I think it is on Shudder. I think I saw the
Yeah, I think
poster.
It's on Amazon too. Like it's in a few places you can get. It's I don't know what the distribution rights are right now, but I don't think it's tightly held clutched in anyone's hands. I think that they're probably not going to intend to fix this up anytime soon.
That's too bad. Yeah. That's it's also one of the great movie posters.
Oh, yes. It's a cool movie poster for sure. So what about you guys? What did you dig up for Small Town Horror?
I'll go first if you don't mind, Eric, because I used this opportunity to see a film that a bunch of people have talked about forever and I just never got around to seeing. And that is from 1973, Messiah of Evil.
They say that nightmares are dreams perverted. I've told them here it wasn't a nightmare, but they don't believe me. They nod and make little notes in my file. Not far from here, there's a small town on the coast. They used to call it New Bethlehem, but they changed the name to Point Doom after the moon turned blood red. Point Doom doesn't look any different than 1,000 other neon stucco towns. But what happened there, what they did to me, what they're doing now, they're coming here. They're waiting at the edge of the city. They're peering around buildings at night. And they're waiting for you. And they'll take you one by one, and no one will hear you scream. No one will hear you scream!
Never heard of this film.
Either this
is it about Jesus?
Prominent on my list to see, or I've seen it and it's been a long time. I don't remember for sure, but I definitely know this film.
This is a weird movie, and I'm glad I saw it. I don't know if I liked it, but I liked enough of it. The budget, I know, is less than $1 million, but I could find no information on the box office. I would think that it is also less than $1 million. Nothing for the Rotten Tomatoes critics, but the audience has it at 56%.
Okay.
Here's where this gets weird. This was written and directed by a guy named Willard Hike and Gloria Katz. You might not know their names, but they both wrote the movie Howard the Duck, which Willard directed.
Oh.
And they were the writers of American Graffiti, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and the Radioland Murders, among others. They were very close friends with a young George Lucas.
Yeah.
So it's one of these things where you're like, oh, I'm kind of expecting a little bit of greatness out of this, at least story-wise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Oh, no.
It stars Michael Greer, who has done episodes of Mannix, Ironside, Streets of San Francisco before his death in 2002. Mm. He will be missed. Mariana Hill, who has 84 credits, including High Plains Drifter, Godfather Part II, and tons of 60s and 70s television. And Joy Bang, who did a ton of 70s TV, including Mission Impossible, Hawaii Five-O, Adam 12, and Police Story. And she is a really cute girl next door.
I have to say, by the way, I found more and more people popping up in Police Story, which I have never seen. Yeah.
Oh, man, that was a staple at the Young household. Police Story was a good one. I'm going to give you the IMDb synopsis of this story. Uh-oh. My bird is not happy about it. Don't worry, I'm going to go into detail afterwards. Here's what IMDb says the story is. A young woman goes searching for her missing artist father. Her journey takes her to a strange Californian seaside town governed by a mysterious undead cult.
Ooh.
Now, that is kind of what this movie is about.
Oh, okay. No.
But let me just say, this movie is full of nightmare logic. So a lot of creepy scenes mm-hmm. that don't quite tie into each other and don't really make sense okay. in the context of the story. But the scenes are creepy. It just, this synopsis just ignores how fucking weird this movie is. So it starts off with a man running down a deserted street at night, and he's being chased, but we don't see by who or what. A doorway in a yard opens around a gate, and this girl signals the man to come in. She's like, come on, come on, come on. And he's like, oh, he's terrified, so he's thinking, you know, all right, I'll get in there. He collapses next to a swimming pool, and she comes to his side and then takes a big straight razor and slashes his throat. So that's the opening scene, and I was like, all right, here we go. Then we meet Arletty.
Arletty?
Arletty is
name or a
that's,
job?
That's the name of the protagonist of this film.
Arletty?
Arletty.
Is that like one word?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought Arletty. You were saying Our Lady really badly.
Oh, why? Because you've never heard of this name and certainly not as a protagonist of a film?
Yes, you're right.
Okay, that's where I was too. They kept saying her name and I was like, Arletty? Yeah, Arletty.
Wow.
She is narrating the film and she's going to the seaside town of Point Dune. After losing contact with her father, who is the artist in the synopsis above.
That is a very good name, by the way.
Point Dune?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I did love this, and it really, you said small town horror, and I was like, well, what am I going to do? Because we've talked about The Fog, we've talked about so many movies, and I realized, oh, this is such a staple of the horror genre, is the small town, because, you know, once you get into a city, you can get police, you can get whatever you need to help you.
Isolation.
Yeah. So she stops for gas at a gas station in town, where she finds the attendant firing his rifle into the darkness at something.
Don't you do that normally at night?
He puts the gun away and comes to pump her gas.
Oh, that's nice.
Mm-hmm. And a pickup truck pulls in right next to her, driven by a strange-looking albino man. While he goes to refuel the truck, the attendant lifts up the back tarp on this truck, and we see the dead man who'd had his throat slashed.
Oh.
And the attendant says nothing. He just covers the tarp up, and he quickly shoos Arletty away.
And I got stuff to do.
In a way that is so weirdly obvious that if you were a real human, you'd go, what the fuck is going on? Because she attempts to pay for gas, and he's like, no time.
The only gas station on planet Earth where they don't want you to pay.
Right. So she goes to her father's home, which appears abandoned, and it is covered in all of these great, creepy murals. He's an artist, and whatever is his muse lately is something very dark and creepy. She's, you know, can't find any news of him, so she goes to the town art gallery and gets a lead on a few people who might know where he is. And one of them is Tom, who appears to be about 9 feet tall and weighs 140 pounds, maybe.
Oh, my.
That is Michael Greer. This guy is who's the effects guy that we love that comes to the con all the time, who's in makeup for...
Doug Jones.
This guy is Doug Jones looking. He's rail thin and super tall. And he is somehow the male protagonist of this film. This wouldn't be so weird, except this is 1973, so he's wearing a white outfit with a vest and bell bottoms. And
is there a disco in this small town?
No, but there's disco in the world, so
he doesn't care if his friends make fun of him. He's gonna be part of the scene.
It's strip time.
Tom explains to her that he is a collector of regional legends. Whatever the fuck that means.
A human being who has ears.
He appears to be pretty interested in her. Okay. And so he's trying to hit it off with her. But while all of this is going on, there seems to be a very slow takeover of the town by some kind of zombie vampire-geddon thing. I can't tell what these things are.
Sure.
They are zombie-ish, but without the mindless part. They actually have a purpose. So people keep showing up in the film.
I have a theory. Oh. Maybe they're people dead and buried that have gone on.
It could be.
That's true. They did. They do need something to do.
Well, they would have. This was 73. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
his early experiments went better.
But that doesn't mean that Dead and Buried wasn't a prequel that was made later on.
Hey, they call another town, and that guy was doing stuff in that town. So
these people kind of show up throughout the film, and you can tell that they're infected because they are acting just kind of out of it, and they are also bleeding from their eyes.
Oh.
And not in like a gory, bloody way. They'll just be talking to you, and then all of a sudden you see like a red teardrop drip down their eyes, and that's how you know, uh-oh. And they don't seem to even know that it's happening. They are crazy for meat.
What kind of meat?
Well,
just like you.
They don't really seem to care where it comes from. The meat section at a supermarket is one of the places where they just go crazy and start devouring meat. One of the guys also attacks a mouse and eats it live. And Arletty is at the supermarket when the meat section attack is going on, and they attack her, and I think they kill her.
Wait.
You think?
Well, because in the very next scene, she is walking along, and I was like, is that a dream? Did that happen? Huh. I don't really know. The movie just continues on with her immediately after that in a different scene, and she does not appear to have been killed. But we do see that she is starting to behave weirdly. She cuts herself and doesn't feel pain, and she's got a cut on her ear, which looks like it's badly infected, stuff like that. So you realize, okay, I think that she has been infected with whatever is going on in the town. But shouldn't that be a plot point that is clear to you?
Yeah, since you were introduced to this entire story through her.
Right.
Hmm.
So finally, she finds her father, who explains that the townspeople have been infected by a century-old curse brought on by a dark stranger who rode into town on a horse 100 years ago. He was a survivor of the Donner Party.
Oh, of course.
And he brought with him this curse of cannibalism, after which he walked into the sea, promising to return in 100 years when the moon turns blood red.
Oh.
Then her father attacks her, and she has to kill him by setting him on fire.
But she's evil, right? Because she's been infected?
Well, okay, so you see where while I was watching this movie.
But, like, yeah, and her dad, it sounds like, isn't necessarily a bad guy or something.
No, he was infected.
Oh. So they're both infected. So, well, they should just hang out and have a cup of tea.
There's a ton more in this film. I'm not going to give it all away, although I think that she is the messiah of evil that this movie is talking about.
Okay.
But I can't be quite sure. There is one scene that I want to talk about that is so fucking great, though, and it's ripped off from Alfred Hitchcock, clearly. You know, there's the scene in The Birds where the woman is sitting at the park and then, like, a bird lands behind her, and then, you know, the next scene, there's 10 birds behind her, and pretty soon she's just surrounded by birds, and she doesn't realize it because she's reading a book. In this, one of the young girls in here, Joy Bang.
No.
That's the actress's name.
Oh.
I can only imagine, though, that she is
so
a Joy.
So unfortunate.
To bang.
Rough school years there.
She goes to the theater by herself, and she sits down, and it's an empty theater. And then you just start seeing people walking in and sitting behind her, clearly these infected zombie things, but just one at a time. So you look up, and all of a sudden there's 3 people behind her, and then there's 10 people behind her, and then pretty soon the entire theater is filled up, and there are people like sitting right next to her, and she gets up to kind of move away, and then this other person comes in on the other side of the aisle, and she kind of looks back and sees all these weird looking people, and she's, oh no. So she jumps up and starts climbing over the chairs, and of course they all attack her on the stage in front of the screen, and big huge bloody red handprint on the white screen, and it's just a great scene. Doesn't make a lot of sense in the context of the film, but it's a good scene. The thing is, these guys are good writers. I mean, Howard the Duck is not a great film, but American Graffiti, Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom, you know, those are good films. So, trivia. Michael Greer, the star, who was 9 feet, There's a scene in the movie where these cops are doing something, right? Well, I found out in the trivia that Michael Greer was once pulled over by the cops who appeared in the film during the shooting of the film, but they had not been paid. So they arrested him and contacted the director and demanded payment for the roles or they were going to throw him into jail.
Oh, my God.
Guess what? They were paid.
Oh, my God. Man. That's so good. This is why you don't mess with locals.
Right.
Yes. Small town. Mm.
The actress posted in her blog in 2011 that this was shot in 1971. The movie was originally titled The Second Coming. Towards the end of the filming, investors pulled their money out and the film was never finished.
Whoa.
A Frenchman bought the unedited footage, edited it, and released the movie under the title Messiah of Evil. In 2003, in the horror film genre, the British Film Institute hailed Messiah of Evil as a rare work of cinematic genius.
Excellent.
Wow.
I figured out why I know this film.
Okay.
I was on Diabolik DVD ordering because they're having a big sale. I ordered this because it was one of their half-off prices. Like, this looks awesome. Read the reviews. The review referenced that scene in the theater you're talking about as being great. Going, oh, shit. This sounds like right up my alley. So, some point in time in the next couple of weeks.
I was going to say, is it sat on your shelf, like collecting dust, or is in the mail?
I ordered it recently enough that I don't have received it yet.
I can't wait to hear what you think of it.
Oh, my God.
I loved this piece of trivia. It was re-released in 1978 as Return of the Living Dead. And advertised with images taken from Night of the Living Dead's ad campaign, as well as Dawn of the Dead's tagline, when there is no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth. George Romero sued the distributor,
as you would,
citing unfair competition, and won a restraining order in 78, preventing the film from being shown under this title, though sporadic engagements did occur into 1979.
Oh, wow.
And finally, the weirdest piece of trivia. This movie, Messiah of Evil, along with House of Exorcism, is shown on a movie marquee in the movie Annie Hall.
Oh.
Sure.
Okay.
New York. 42nd Street?
Yeah, New York seems like... In New York 75. When was that, Annie Hall? 77. New York 77. This seems like exactly the kind of movie you would find playing a double bill.
Yeah. Nice.
Wow, what a crazy, I don't know, like that sounds like an awesome film to see, but what the hell?
It was an experience. I mean, I made myself a steak and had some wine and I just let this thing kind of wash over me. I didn't, there were parts where I like cut steak and then I'd look up and I'd go, do I need to rewind this? I was cutting steak for 10 seconds maybe? I feel like I have completely lost the narrative.
Well, mine is definitely different, although I was surprised at it. So I'm doing the research, and I say small town horror. I was like, oh, well, let's see what's out there. You Google whatever I Googled, and this thing popped up about cockroaches that burn people.
What? Like,
I remember this movie.
Like with lighters? Like they have little cockroach lighters?
Yeah, that's what it is. No, it's like lightning bugs, but their ass burns. And so I'm like, oh, I know I've seen this. Like when I was very young, I thought it was a made-for-TV movie, which turns out it wasn't. But this is a film from 1975 called Bug.
It was a day like any other. The air hung heavy with the heat. Then it happened. A crack in the land that reached to the very bowels of the earth itself, spitting out the fires of hell. And the gleaming black bug that had no eyes and looked like a rock. It traveled in the exhaust pipes of cars, making fire, killing, and infesting the land with a burning terror. Wherever you turned, the bug was waiting. Ready to grasp you in its soul-chilling grip of terror, to push you beyond human endurance and leave you in a state of blood-boiling fear that will drag you to the brink of your sanity. One man was determined to learn its secrets, to discover how it grew and what it needed to survive.
The Parmiteras will eat only raw meat, any kind.
At first, it ate only ashes, but now it needed meat, and it would get that meat from whatever source it could. It was a creature from hell, and nothing could stop it. The bug lives. The bug grows. The ordinary becomes the extraordinary as the bug brings you the ultimate experience in terror. A terror so real, it will make your skin crawl, your heart pound, and your soul scream for release from the bug. You won't live alone, if you live at all, when the bug comes to your house.
Which is, I thought when I was looking up reading about, man, this is going to be hard to find. I hope it's for rent all over the place.
Oh. Okay.
Surprisingly available. The Rotten Tomatoes is a little harsh, but not off base. 33 from the critics, 25 from the crowd. Budget, I don't know, but it did make $3,600,000 at the box office. So it wasn't a total disaster. Directed by Jeannot Szwarc. 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 S-Z-W-A-R-C.
Szwarc.
Szwarc. Who has directed 15 episodes of Grey's Anatomy, 19 episodes of Night Gallery, Jaws 2, and Somewhere in Time.
Aww.
The romantic.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's great. What an odd career this person has had.
But... based on an amazing Richard Matheson story.
Yes, exactly. You haven't seen that
No,
one?
I've never heard of it.
Stars Superman, and who's the woman in it?
Jane.
Oh, huge actress from the, but it's a really.
Dr. Quinn, medicine woman.
Oh,
Jane
yeah,
Seymour.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's
excellent.
Cool.
Romantic film.
Yeah, it really is.
Written by, it's based on a book by Thomas Page. Who also helped with the screenplay, the main writer, William Castle.
What? Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Famous writer of 13 Ghosts and The Tingler.
The Tingler.
Among many others. Stars Bradford Dillman. This movie is full of people you go, oh, I know that face. Oh, I know that. Everybody I looked up was like 80 credits or higher.
All that guy's.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, that guy.
Yep. So Bradford Dillman, who is in 8 episodes of Murder, She Wrote, playing a different character every time he was on.
I love that so much.
He basically made an appearance per season. Piranha. Let's see. Played the captain in 2 Dirty Harry movies, but not the same captain. let's see. Joanna Mills. The Ultimate Warrior movie. Star Trek Next Gen. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And a couple more here. Richard Gilliland, who's in everything on TV in the last 30 years. And Airplane 2. Jamie Smith Jackson, who's in All the President's Men. And I was like, oh, cool, Planet of the Apes. Oh, the TV series. So I was like, all right.
Reel it back.
But just full of people you've seen. I thought it was a made-for-TV movie, but it's not. It was actually a theatrical release. The movie started up, but I started playing the rental. I'm going, what's wrong with the sound? I mean, the thing, Paramount or whatever logo comes up. Everything's going, I'm not hearing anything. There's virtually no sound for a minute and a half in this movie.
Oh.
Because a car started to drive up. I could hear the gravel going, oh, okay, there's really just no sound.
Weird. It's
very strange. And it starts with the subtle irony of a giant earthquake in church. And let me tell you, the director and or writer wasn't being subtle about their feeling on church and it not being important for anything. Because it starts off with this huge giant scene in church and the preacher going off on various stuff. And then the earthquake happens and they never address the church again.
Do you think it's like anti-exorcist? Like they were like, hey,
no.
This is a stupid topic.
I think it's just the guy didn't like preachers or something.
Religion or something.
But this crack in the earth creates where a bunch of bugs now come up out of the earth. And they do kind of look like cockroaches, look very large cockroaches. But they introduce to you to how damaging these guys are by an incredibly brutal scene of a cat being taken out.
Ooh.
So I will give a high old warning for anybody who has problems watching animals get beat up in a movie, because this cat gets beat the fuck up.
Does it look like they injured a cat?
It was hard to tell, which was the problem.
Yeah.
It almost looked like they might have done not like strong electric shots, but like static electricity or something like that to get the cat to jump around in various ways. It was not pleasant scene. But, move on. It's a 70s movie.
How big are these bugs?
About twice the size. Well, no, about when you go to a museum or something, you see cockroaches like the Science Center here in Seattle. The larger ones, they're like the largest ones you might see in that, like hissing cockroaches.
So they're not like 3 feet?
No.
Not cat-sized.
No. That would have been much better. Got the cat a shitload faster. But the then movie goes to our hero, who's a biology teacher. I thought it was high school, but I guess it turns out it's college. There's really no indication. He takes the bug to being tested, and the guy who tests it says, this bug is virtually unkillable. He's got a horribly strong as steel outside and immune to bacteria or any kind of thing we use to normally kill. It's like super cockroaches. And they, the way they set fires is basically like, it's like a lightning bug. Their butts light up, but they super heat because they came from the middle of the earth or some shit like that. They're unkillable, but they are really catchable. He figures out basically you light a newspaper on fire and they start to eat the carbon because that's what they live off of. They make their own food with fire. It's all actually fairly well thought out.
Oh.
You know, believable is beside the point, but it's at least well thought out and follows its own rules fairly well. So that's nice. Oh, and yeah, my least favorite film scene from it that I think is the movie I really remembered when I watched this, where there's a bug on a phone. A lady picks up the phone. And, you know, Star Trek 2.
Oh, right. Like the creator starts burning. Does it melt her head?
Not quite. She lives, sort of. There's a really strange scene where he finds a weakness in the bugs, where he turns one of them over and pokes him with something. And it's just this, if it was a human, it'd be horribly gory. All this stuff starts flying out of the bug. It looks like when they kill the androids in Alien and Aliens, all the shit that comes out of him, the way that looks, that white milky stuff. It looks like that, but it's like exploding up into the air because they're not pressurized properly this level. So when he made a little hole in them, they went. Pfft. So apparently their undercarriage is very, very weak, which realistically never comes into play again.
Oh, man.
That seems like the answer.
That's what I thought. I was researching this. I was proven to found out correct. I'm watching this one scene. Lady goes in the kitchen. It's like, that's the Brady kitchen. She's in the Brady house. It was the set that they used for the Brady Bunch.
That's so weird.
Because you go in and there's that weird fireplace in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Which is so bizarrely distinctive. It's like, did people have that in the 70s?
This is a thing.
It starts out really well. It's one of those things where you look at how far into this movie am I? Like, damn, I'm already like half an hour into this film. And then the next 30 minutes starts.
Oh, no.
It's like, oh, drags a lot. Because they decide to take the professor and he decides for, I don't know, stupid scientist reasons. Like just because Jurassic Park line didn't think if you can do a thing, you should do a thing. He decides he's going to figure out how to reproduce them.
What?
So he gets them to have like bug sex with other cockroaches, which results in them being able to spell letters on the wall.
Oh my god.
Spell
so
words
good.
Onto the wall to him communicating with him. Like okay.
English?
Are they nice?
Yep.
Are they like do they good intentions?
No. They want food. tries to kill them with pressure and stuff. I mean, it's not a giveaway to say that you're watching this movie going, there's no way this is going to end well for the humans. And it doesn't.
Yeah.
So if you're really interested in, spoiler alert.
I like that you spoiled it first and then gave a spoiler.
No, I haven't yet.
Oh, okay.
Now I'm going to. Because his experimenting, he ends up creating flyable versions of these
bugs. Oh my God.
So it ends with these, they go back into the earth, but then they mutate and start flying out in droves out of this. Like,
what year is this from?
75.
What are the effects like?
Not bad. Okay. I mean, it's decent enough for what it's doing. It works. It's largely real bugs most of the time.
So how do they do the flying then? Are they just getting flying cockroaches?
That's one of the not so good effects. It looks like rear projection.
Ah, okay.
It's rear projection work. You know what? I enjoyed this film.
Good.
I was really, I'm always hesitant to look back on something I think I enjoyed when I was pretty young going, oh, but this was enjoyable. It's not great.
Yeah.
If you like William Castle, you're going to be just fine because it's better than most of his films.
This had to be like towards the end of William Castle's life, right?
William Castle's last film.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
it was the last film he worked on. He wasn't director or anything like that, but it sounds like he was relatively involved as a producer. I don't even think he's credited as a producer, but it's William Castle, so you know he's doing something. This movie featured, I had to look this car up, a 1972 AMC Javelin SST.
Oh, I love the Javelins.
It's a car that looks really cool and then doesn't from another angle. That's why I thought it was really interesting. This looks so cool. What the hell? It's cool, but it's weird. But
it's a hot rod. It's a muscle car, but it's also 1972, which means that it, you know, like the interior is super plain and it's got a lot of flat panels on it and everything, but it was definitely a muscle car.
Oh yeah. It's nice. You know, I had to go back to the IMDb of cars.
Look
it up.
If you can find a 72 AMC Javelin, you're paying, you know, $30,000.
Oh jeez. I knew he'd know that. let's see. What do we got here? Set of Paramount Studios. That's where they had the Brady House that they used.
Mm.
What the hell? You know, they cut and pasted something from Wikipedia, and it's so much more just about the Brady. Due to poor ratings, the series had been canceled by 1974, so Paramount was using it in many films.
That is so good.
Fucking Oliver is when they brought Oliver in, remember?
That's right. But, William Castle wanted to do a gimmick, of course, and they didn't let him do it. But he wanted to set it up to the point where there were bushes crowding the entrance to the theaters enough that people would have to brush against them and kind of feel like maybe bugs were touching their legs.
Oh my god!
Like, it's either this or I want to light everything on fire at the end of the movie.
You get A or you get B.
Apparently, Joanna Miles was deathly afraid of cockroaches, and she's got a scene where she's got two or three of them on her. And William Castle, this is why I'm going, did he kind of co-direct this or something? William Castle came out and said, let me show you how harmless these are. Took one of them, put him on his arm, and it bit him.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
That never works out well. Like that guy who killed himself trying to prove that blanks aren't dangerous.
Oh, no.
Some guy in the late 70s or late 80s, he was a Rockford Files kind of show he was on. And one of the guest stars was...
Oh, I know you're John Wesley. Yeah, I know who
something
you're
something like
about.
That, yeah. He's sort of that kind of a character. And
put the gun up to his head. And
the cotton swab. Like, it's not like a regular gun, but don't do that.
Don't play with guns, kids.
So there's a lot of similarities, which of a list of a movie that I've been wanting to see for a while, which I haven't, called Phase 4.
Yes, I don't mind to see that for a bit.
It's not great, but it's fun.
And we'll close with the movie tagline. They look like rocks, possess high intelligence, have no eyes, and eat ashes. They travel in your car exhaust. They make fire. They kill.
Wow, that's so much information. I feel like it's like a textbook like rundown with like a little photo of the guy rather than like, come see this movie. Yes. It's like, let's tell you about these bugs.
They do. They get into like cars and cars explode all over because they're getting into gas lanes and stuff.
I'm kind of intrigued by this movie.
It's fun. It's well worth watching, especially with, you know, the 70s sensibilities
you've
got towards films. I think you would like it. But
all right.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, this is going to suck. I watched it going, you know what? This is pretty damn entertaining.
Yo, Vanessa, cool. Good pick for
I'm
the genre.
I'm so glad this worked out well.
This is one I think we can revisit because, as I said, there's so many small-town horror films.
Yeah, it's prolific.
Okay, so that means that the next genre pick is mine.
Ooh, what are you thinking?
I am thinking, well, we've done not one, but two episodes on ghosts, mm-hmm. but it's still something that I love. Sure. And I thought we would do ghosts with a little twist. So your movie has to have a ghost in it, at least one, but it can't be a horror movie.
Ooh.
So, like non-horror movie ghost movies.
Like does ghost? It have to Look, have making pots?
For example, Ghost Dad with Bill Cosby is a movie with a ghost in it. It is not a horror film. Anyway, thanks to everyone who is liking, sharing, all of the reposting, all of the stuff. We got some fun stuff in the group messaging from Ron Forbick, which I thought was really neat.
Yeah.
So I just really appreciate all the people who listen and comment and who say lovely things about us.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for being part of the community. It really gives me a reason to look on Facebook ever that's like not super negative.
So. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
True.
Okay, so that is it for this week. We will be back next week. We're talking ghost stories that aren't horror stories.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our show is recorded somewhere high above Naval Station Everett at the nexus of all realities and is engineered and produced by Eric Margaret. Our theme music is Strange Eons Part 1 by the band Nightshade and is used with permission. Find Strange Eons Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and wherever fine podcasts are found.